This is another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, celebrating 40 plus years on the fringe of show business. Stories, interviews, and comedy sets from the famous and not so famous. Here's your host and MC, Scott Edwards.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another fabulous podcast, and we have another terrific interview with a professional entertainer, and I mean professional. This guy's been seen on Showtime, Comedy All-Stars, Comedy Central's A-List, Evening at the Improv, Star Search, MTV's Half Hour Comedy Hour. He sings, he does impressions, he's a terrific stand-up comedy, and we used to do some really, really fun stuff, including he is the star of Vegarama. Ladies and gentlemen, it's my good friend Rick Corso. Wow, Rick. Great to have you.
Great to hear your voice, Scott. That couldn't have been a live audience clapping. I mean, I hate to criticize right up front.
Well,
we can only
fit so many people in the studio.
It's show business, right? You got to really just put on some fake stuff once in a while.
Yeah, so we haven't actually talked in a long time, but back in the day, we were doing a lot of work and a lot of experimental comedy together, and I've always been a huge fan of, for the audience that's listening, not only, I mentioned it earlier, he sings, he does impressions, but you do one of the best Frank Sinatra, you know, old school lounge, you know, Italian lounge singer act, and always been really impressed with everything. But before we get into comedy, I wanted to kind of explore how you got into comedy. Now, is everybody in the listening audience sitting down? Because Rick Corso is an engineer, a fully degreed engineer, and worked on nuclear plants, right?
That's correct. Wow, you really have my information.
Well,
that's true. When you say how you got into comedy, I think I got to do the long version because you want to give it context, right?
Yeah.
So it starts out somehow in your past, somebody gives you the idea that you're actually funny and you can pull it off. Something gives you that confidence, right? So there was a couple of instances. One was I was like in seventh grade music class, and before the bell rang and the class started, I just started doing an Elvis impression. And everybody was laughing, and the teacher walked in, and he made me do it in front of the class, and it just killed. And I didn't even do it well. It was just the fact that I had the nerve to do it. So that kind of planted a little seed in me. I did some sketches in the church comedy show. And then in college, I was in a fraternity, and, you know, I played the guitar since I was a kid. And I used to just make up these silly comedy songs at the fraternity, and you know, I was funny. And I also did impressions. I always did impressions. And then I went to college for engineering, like you said, and I graduated, you know, wanted to go the safe route, got a job working in the nuclear plant in Washington State, and then another one in Cincinnati. After that, I kept getting like more, you know, moving to a better paid job because I really didn't like it. So it was about the money. And then I realized that they don't really build nuke plants in fun suburban or urban areas. You know, you're always out in the middle of nowhere. And I wanted to live where there was, you know, I wanted to live where there was people and fun. So I was trying to get a job shift over from nuclear construction to commercial construction. So I moved in with a friend of mine in Atlanta who was really wired, and he went to Rutgers with me, and he had a great construction engineering job. So I was there auditioning. I mean, not auditioning. Things changed. Interviewing for jobs in the Atlanta area. You know, living with him as a roommate because he was just going through a breakup with his girl, and he had an extra room. So I stayed there and I did some interviewing. And while I was doing that, I got one more nuclear job that paid so much money. I said, let me go out to California. But in the meantime, while I was living there and unemployed between engineering jobs, something came up. It was a best portrayal of a Saturday Night Live character, the contest, right?
Oh, really?
So I go, so I said to myself, I do a good Father Guido Sarducci impression. Let me do that. Get in the contest, maybe I'll win a little money. So I worked on this thing, and then I find out about the contest. It's not portray, it's not an impression, it's a costume contest. It's like, oh, you didn't work on that, the whole thing. So then somebody told me about the open mic scene in Atlanta. There was a thing called the Great Southeastern Laugh-Off that was held at the Comedy Spot that was in Buckhead. That was only open, about 82, 83. It was only up for a couple of years. So I got into that, and the audition was in the room in front of just like three people. And because I had never done comedy before, I had my stuff so memorized that it didn't throw me that there was no audience. You know, normally a comic that's used to performing, no audience, this will be weird. But I passed the audition. So my first time on stage was in front of this packed house that was there. And, you know, I think of all the Atlanta comics at the time who was on, like James Gregory and Paul Clay and Greg Ray and Grant Turner and J. Anthony Brown. And they had some good comics, you know. But, and who's this guy? I mean, I never done it before. First time. And I was doing kind of a similar thing to what I still do. It's just this tough guy Jersey character as I was, you know, just mimicking people from my neighborhood. And I didn't see the edge of the stage, and I fell off the stage. So I went from being this tough guy Jersey character. Excuse me, pardon me. And some big guys lifted me back on stage. I finished my set. It was one of the best shows I've had in the whole first year of comedy. So you had that first good show. You get bitten by the bug. And then you bomb for 20 weeks, you know, that's what happens. You're chasing that dragon. You're trying to get back to where you were that first time. And that's what happened. So I did that, you know, a bunch of open mics. And then I got the engineering job offer to go to California. It was Diablo Canyon I worked at. Diablo Beach. And because my heart wasn't really in it, I was, you know, kind of slacking off at work. My boss caught me reading the want ads. I was looking for a new car and I got fired. I took that as a sign.
Yeah.
I took that as a sign. Yeah, to get into comedy, and I moved down to L.A. And I moved to L.A. and tried L.A. the L.A. scene. After only doing comedy a couple of months, it was very hard. But you know, I was lucky; I got a job at the Comedy Store as a doorman, and that made me a lot of connections. I got a lot of stage time. There was a tour bus that used to park in front of the Comedy Store, and I used to get up on there because one day Howie Mandel went up on the tour bus, and I go, "This is great! I could do that and get stage time," you know. And so I used to go on the bus. And I would do like a set, and they would pass the hat around. And Mitzi didn't like it. She said, "You do the bus, but take off. Don't wear the Comedy Store T-shirt. It looks bad, you know." And sometimes, even if I wasn't working the door that night, the girl that worked the cover booth said, "Rick, hurry up! Your bus is here." And I have to drive down because you want stage time, you know.
Oh, so that's the bus, so funny! The early bus. Yeah, you got in with Mitzi Shore early on.
Very early on, I was only doing it about 9 or 10 months, and I just got lucky. It's a 3-minute audition. I had a really good set, and she looked at me like a guy that could work the door. So the next day, she didn't say, "You're a regular." She said, "You want a job?" So I took the job as a doorman, and I never became a paid regular there, by the way. I became a non-paid regular. Then I became a doorman, a phone answerer, and then a personal errand guy. So I ran errands there. Sometimes I was there 16 hours a day. Like I'd go in at 10 o'clock and be the errand guy.
I had no idea that rich history with Mitzi.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, I saw Paulie recently because he's, you know, I'm in Vegas now. I was working the Laugh Factory back in February with John Mulrooney, and they gave John the second show Monday off because Paulie came in and packed the place. And I hadn't seen Paulie in like 25 years, but I remember taking him to the airport for his mom. Everything, you know, it was a long time. He was a kid. So, it is a long history.
Amazing.
Harry Basil kind of runs the Laugh Factory. He was one of the regular guys there at the time. And it's all coming back to me.
The connections that you can make working the door at a club are amazing. Oh, especially
Store. Those guys. Well, that's what happened. Was those guys helped me get on the road, like Jeff Cesario and Billy Anderson, and actually Bob Saget and Harry Basil. They helped me get. Like I would just drop their name, and I was okay if I drop your name, and I drop the name, and I'd get the club booking.
That
reminds me, you had another question about how did I get into Laughs. I don't remember. I think Laughs came later because I started getting jobs middling and starting to build up my act. And then somebody told me how great your clubs were. You had Citrus Heights and Old Sack. And I think what happened was I did Rascals Comedy Hour, which was a cable show in New Jersey at the comedy club there because I was a feature there. And then that tape I sent to you, remember VHS tapes?
Yeah.
And then you booked me to MC. So I MC'd there a couple of times. But you know what? I was thinking back about this. I never featured for you. I MC'd, got a lot of TV stuff and started working the road. And then when I got a Showtime special, I came back to you as a headliner. I never featured there.
Well, it's interesting, but we've jumped ahead a little bit just to give us a reference, Rick. How old were you when you kind of went from a nuclear engineer to comedy?
23 years old.
So in the comedy business, that's a little bit of a late start. I mean, a lot of the guys started in their teens and early 20s, but 23 is still young.
Oh, yeah.
And then
But I think 23, if I started when I was 18, I might not have missed the wave. Like, I think I missed the wave of getting on the big TV stuff, you know, like the guys in SNL and in Living Color, they had their chops were much stronger. I was, you know, I came very close to getting in Living Color, but the note after three auditions was, hey, he doesn't have acting experience, so we could tell, you know?
Yeah. You just missed that crest. Now going back to when you were starting, what was one of your first jokes or impressions? Do you remember?
I did Popeye a long, long time ago. And that was my killer closer. I did, you know, I just did impressions that I did since I was a kid. And Popeye was a closer. I did.
Where are you working at in Vegas?
Really. I did. Don Barnhart has a gig downtown called Delirious. This is the Grand Hotel. And I just finished four nights there. I had a one nighter before. So I was here for five nights.
Oh, congratulations. That's great that you picked right back up on the work. This post COVID stuff has tough on
and
the
I've been
industry.
Back to, well, the other thing is I've been back to ships since November, so I'm still doing that. And Florida didn't really shut down, and I have some gigs in Florida that I was doing throughout 2020, 2021. I mean, there's a variety show that I work in Florida called The Jungle Queen. It's been there since the 30s, and it's the longest-running variety show in the country. And it's usually a singer, a variety act, a comedian, and then the dancers at the end. So I'm always in that third spot, and you know, it's like you call in for spots for the month, and then they give you what you can. And if you get a better gig, like a ship or something, you trade out with somebody else. And it's been working out good for me.
Oh, getting that's
super
great, Rick.
Spanking clean because there's kids in the audience. But that's no problem. You're doing 15 minutes. And it's a nice gig. So that really didn't, that I think that only shut down for like 2 months. And it opened up at lower capacity, and then people wear masks and all that stuff. And now it's back to full, you know, 400 people in an outdoor amphitheater.
That's amazing. Well, we've jumped ahead again, but let's take it back to Laughs Unlimited. You were doing some MC work, and then I obviously recognized your talent. You were getting a lot of TV spots. We were talking about the Showtime Comedy All-Star Show, An Evening at the Improv. So you were quickly made into a headliner, which is the way I've always thought of you anyway. I mean, not only...
that was exactly at the Showtime Comedy Club All-Star thing. Solidified me as a headliner, and that's when I came back. But you know, it wasn't that there was anything wrong with our communication. I was just starting to get work elsewhere. Then I guess like probably that was the new tape, or you saw it on TV, and my manager at the time contacted me. He said, "Yeah, we'll have him as a headliner." That's what happened.
Yeah, well, you have so much talent, Rick. I mean, you bring, as we've already mentioned, you sing, you do. Impressions, you have great material, so I'm it's hard for me to think of you as anything but a headliner. Do you have any memories of working those days at Laughs Unlimited?
Oh yeah, and you know what, I do remember how I heard about you. Remember the Seth magazine Just for Laughs?
And
it would print where the comics were every week, and I would see your club, you always had these good guys, you know, and I go, yeah, I want to work in that. And that's how I got in the first time. That's why I took the gig as the MC, because I just wanted to work there. I always had great lineups. What was the last question? I'm sorry.
No, I was just was curious.
Oh, memories from the club.
Yeah, you worked the club quite a bit. And then
You were really nice to me in that, like, I think before and after Vega Rami, sometimes you let me bring my own middle, which was always fun because we could drive up together. I don't know if you remember, one of the middles was Jimmy Dore, who's very big now. He's got a political podcast. You know Jimmy Dore, remember him?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that was one of the things I would offer the headliners. My whole thing was, if you take care of the entertainers, they'll take care of you. And so if there was a featured act that somebody wanted to work with, I would trust the headliner. He's not going to put somebody crappy or dirty in front of him, right? So it was always
he's going to bring somebody he could follow. Yeah,
right. It's
and
a
then,
fairly
and
safe
be good
bet.
For the show.
Yeah, it's a fairly
and
safe
then John
bet.
Manfilotti was the other one I brought with me, and he, you know, he did Raymond, and he did Men of a Certain Age. He's got a lot of acting work. He's done very well as well. The other times I was there, I remember being there one time, and you had the winner of your laugh competition as a feature act. That was part of the prize for winning was you get the feature at Laughs Unlimited for the week. But Lori Kilmartin was the MC, and she was really strong. She became a great comic and a great writer. So do you remember this? And then
I don't remember who the act was, but you know,
I would mention it anyway because I don't remember. But after like the first or second day, I go, Scott, I think maybe you need to switch them. And then she featured, and she was fucking phenomenal, you know?
Yeah, no, Lori Kilmartin is amazing. And you're absolutely right. As my job as the producer, it was important to make sure that the show flowed. And if the if the feature act can't follow the opener, you just switch it.
Yes, exactly what you did. But like for stories, I do remember one time when I was there with John Manfilotti, and you know, you were really good to the act. You probably didn't want to have to worry about getting us to it from the club, but you had a car for us to use. That white car, remember that old white car? Yeah. It was Chevy. Well, the first day I came in, I go, Tom, Scott, I think the tires are a little bit bald. You might want to look into that. And then like, the next day, we got a flat on the way to the gig, and you had to come pick us up in the middle of nowhere.
Well, that's how you find out you need new tires, right?
Well, I like to do it. I like to move preemptively, but that worked out okay.
Yeah, it was great times, and having you come in was always special because I'm a big fan of the variety acts. And so when you get somebody like you that can kind of combine the comedy with other things like impressions and singing, Kevin Pollak was amazing with impressions and stand-up.
Oh, Pollak, yeah. But at the time, Pollak was much better at weaving them together. I've since gotten better at it. Because I used to, you know, just it was like two separate things. But now what I do, because I don't know if I told you this, but I didn't play the guitar since I was a kid. Then about, you know, 15 years ago, 25 years into doing stand-up, I finally put it in my act. And it's great. It's like a great last 10 minutes at the end of the show.
Oh, you but play your own guitar for your music. That's awesome.
Not for the Sinatra stuff. Just like I told you, when I was in college, I used to make up stupid songs, like, kind of like the stuff Adam Sandler did, but I just never did it because one time I brought it on stage at the Comedy Store and I had this ovation with the plastic back and the peg with the strap goes on, punched into the guitar. The guitar fell, ruined my set. And I go, that's a sign from God. I'm not going to use the guitar again. Plus, you know, that was the thing about you liked variety acts and for good reason because they gave more to the audience, but the stand-ups all looked down on them. So if you're a young comic in LA, you bow to that pressure of everybody saying, oh, you got to be a pure stand-up, you know? So that was part of the reason that wasn't in the act. It did less impressions than it was. And then I started working shifts and I go, wait, I need this stuff, you know? And it was only like 10 years into me working shifts. So somebody finally said to me, oh, no, this was Tom Cotter. I was on a ship with Tom Cotter and I was in my cabin with the door open playing. I had a Strat with me to carry a Fender Stratocaster and sometimes sitting with the band, you know? And I'm waiting for him to come get me to go to lunch. And in between, on CNN, in between, when you're on a ship, they didn't play the commercials. They just played this dumb hold music. I was playing along with the hold music. And he walks by and goes, you can play that well and you don't use your act. You're a moron. Goes, if you could have 10 minutes of guitar stuff at the end of your act that kills, you could play around and work on new stuff all you want because you know you're always going to close big. I go, wow, I never thought of it that way. And then like a couple of months later, I had it in the act.
Oh, that's great. I'm sorry I haven't seen that. That would be a fantastic addition. And that's a great segue into the fact that you do a great Frank Sinatra impression. You do sing on stage. How did you start with the singing and add comedy, or were you doing comedy and added the singing? How did that come about?
I sang in the choir when I was a kid, and I didn't sing for a long, long time. And then all I did was, you remember that I did the a cappella Sinatra singing the square dance impression, which actually evolved at your club. When I was the MC one time, John Carney was the bill, right?
Oh, yeah, he's good.
I'm a John Carney magician. And I used to literally go to every town. And the premise was Sinatra sings New York, New York, LA is my lady, and Chicago. It seems like he has a song for every town. So the premise was whatever town I went to, I would make up a song for the town. But then John goes, isn't that a lot of work? Why don't you just have him doing something silly? And that's where the square dance bit came from. It's not just singing the square dance, right?
Right.
And you know, but then I listened to an old Sinatra record, and he actually sings Old MacDonald, which was very similar to what I was doing all these years, which is, you know, kind of funny. So I guess I nailed it. But now when I'm on the ships, I sing with the 90s orchestra, and in my act, I do a song parody to That's Life called Ship Life, which, you know, my closer, my Welcome Aboard show. And then I started, like, some of the musical directors would say, hey, why don't you sing with the band? Well, I'll tell you, my friend Gary Morris, they do a big band set. But, like, they were doing it in the afternoon on one of the big ships. And nobody was showing up. And he goes, hey, why don't you come and sing some songs at the band? I go, what do you mean? He goes, isn't that people hear music coming from a lounge and they don't come in, but they hear some motherfucker singing, man. And I walk in. So I started doing the Sinatra songs with the band. And then I made like a whole show out of it. And I actually got booked a couple times on Norwegian Cruise Lines to just be a Sinatra impersonator.
No way.
Because they had their, yeah, I did it twice. I went to Hawaii for 3 weeks and it was great. All I had to do was a 45-minute Sinatra show. But it was tough because I was used to doing it with a 9-piece orchestra and I had to reorchestrate the charts to do with 5, which is really hard. The rehearsal was like 3 hours. And I had to get new charts. And there's a lot to music. It's a hard job.
Yeah,
so but that's why I don't do it full time.
No, but that's fascinating that you took something that was kind of a throwaway impression that you enjoyed. You being Italian, you have a great love of the art form and people like Frank Sinatra, and to have it
Italian
as part
from
of
New Jersey, where he was like our local hero. So it was like, you know, that voice was in my head. It's not like I didn't accidentally become a Sinatra impersonator. I don't think I told you this story. I don't tell many people this. This is, I don't know if this is, if you want comedy on the podcast or if you want.
Oh, no. This is just a conversation. Share away.
Okay. Well, when I was a kid, my mother and father, they were born in the 20s. They loved Sinatra. They were 10 years younger than Sinatra. So he was their idol. My mother was a Bobby Sox. She went to the show, you know, and they loved him. I'm sure I was probably conceived with Sinatra in the background, right? They loved Frank Sinatra. Then I was 7 years old. My father died. He died suddenly at 41 years old.
Oh, wow.
And my mother did nothing but play Sinatra and cry for 3 years solid. So I always feel that you learn how to speak by mimicking your parents, right? And so the male voice around my house was Sinatra. So it wasn't even like I had to consciously learn how to do the impression. It just, you know, there's a great impressionist named Craig Gass. You know him?
No, I don't.
Okay, well, he was on America's Got Talent, one of those shows. I saw him on TV, and they were interviewing him. And he grew up with a family that was all deaf. And they asked him how he became an impressionist. He goes, well, you mimic your parents, your family, but I was able to mimic all these other people because my family was deaf.
Oh, interesting.
I hate to misquote him. But I had that same theory about guys that grew up without fathers, like Billy Crystal's father died when he was young. You learn to do impressions because, you know, you mimic people that you look up to. And then when you start learning how to mimic all different voices, you become an impressionist.
That's fascinating. And that makes so much sense. No, but it's a strong theory. And it makes perfect sense that when there's an empty void, we fill it. And and having Sinatra in the house makes perfect sense. And everybody, you know, keep an eye out for Rick Corso's name on the cruise ships and in Vegas, because if you get a chance to see him, his Sinatra is one of the best I've seen. And you have all the humor to add to it. But I think that's a great story. Thanks for sharing that, Rick.
Yeah, well, I had to tell somebody.
Well, lucky it's me and my listeners. So one of the things that we have to talk about was that I was always open to variety and experimentation.
You took a chance on me. That was really nice.
I was so excited that... we were building this new club and we wanted the grand opening to be spectacular. And I booked Rick and and he had put together kind of a play/variety show called Vegarama. And of course the construction ran long and it kind of blew everything to hell for me, but we had committed to the show. So even though we were in this small banquet room, we brought in this big, you know, over the top show called Vegarama. We had so much fun. The audience loved it. But why don't you explain to the audience the creation and what you did with Vegarama?
Well, you were exactly right. It was a play and a variety show. It was literally a play about a variety show. So, the backstory was that there was this singer, we called him Ricky C. I don't know who that was named after, but, that sounded too much like Sinatra to ever make it. He always lived in Frank's shadow. And he was at once, you know, a decent, this is all backstory, that comes out and we used to have a pre-show voiceover where the guys didn't know the microphones were on. They kind of did the setup, you know. Right? You remember that?
Oh, yeah. Let the audience know the premise of the show.
Yeah. Well, the premise of the show was Well, I'm telling you both at the same time, the premise and this setup to get the backstory out. The premise was that he was too sounded too much like Sinatra to really ever make it. And at one point he made it to a certain level, but he kept getting demoted and demoted from, you know, having a band in a decent sized lounge to a smaller lounge to the band getting to be a smaller band to working to track music, which at the time was audio tapes, cassette tapes, which were in the guy's car and they melted. And, you know, we had a piano player that kind of covered, but then they, you know, you'd try to sing a song or something, all of a sudden the tape would melt. Like, I never really got to a song except for Summerwind, which is one song. I got all the way through. But, and every time I tried to sing, something would happen. Like, you know, I'd be singing Slime of the Moon and the heckler would start and he'd have to get thrown out. And it was, but I hosted a variety show. The premise was the guy that used to have his own show now had to host this variety show, and every act had some problem. We had the mime with Tourette syndrome. We had the Elvis impersonator with a huge ego that was hard to reel in. We had the crazy escape artist with his Mazatlan and Ceviche, I think it was called, right? And he was nuts too. We had the depressed juggler who was off his medication. And, you know, he was doing the bowling ball trick over, you know, he would juggle a bowling ball over a volunteer on stage and he'd drop it. But it was funny because he was depressed. So it wasn't like he was in control. So it made it more dangerous. But yeah, and Todd Glass came in. Todd Glass was the Don Rickles that came in to make fun of him. He played Jackie Brash was the name of the character. And Smirnoff played the club owner. Yeah, he did. But even though you were the actual club owner, you played somebody else in the show. You played like the bouncer, I think, right?
Yeah, I was like Bruce's, you know, he kicked me around. I was his puppy. He would abuse.
Yeah, verbally. Yeah, you worked for Bruce. And which I'm sure he loved. But so we had about 7 or 8 people that came up from L.A., which, you know, and then we had Mo Betterman, who was one of the local comics, and he helped me cast some local actors. And we had Rich Murata, who was just happened to be a great magician, just happened to be here on a magic convention in town. So he doubled up and worked for us too. So we had, it was a really real talent packed show.
Oh, it was so rich with talent. And what I loved about it was it touched on so many variety type comedy. You know, Rich Murata was an amazing comic magician Todd Glass was really funny and fast paced. You had the singing. We had, I can't remember. There was a guy's name that did the amazing impression at the end, kind of a mime bit.
The mime with Tourette syndrome. I forget. I think it must have been Derek. I don't remember who came up. I don't have the flyer in front of me, but you got to give credit to Alan Murray, because not only did he direct it, but he co-wrote it with me. And the sidekick piano player, it was the relationship between he and I that really kind of held, like that glued the show together, you know.
It was amazing fun for me. I was just so depressed that we didn't have it in the main new club that we were having built special, and this was going to be the big breakout grand opening show. But still, we made it work.
You can't really adjust the timing of like 10 people's schedules, you know.
They
committed to me, so that's why we had to do it that way.
No, and it was the fault of the construction people, to be honest. They're always behind. But it's interesting you mentioned Bruce Smirnoff, because in his interview, and people should go back and listen to it, he references how much fun it was, but also how ironic it was that he was the comic that normally respects the club owner. And in this particular show, he was the club owner totally verbally abusing me as his underling, but I was the club owner. I mean, it was funny that it was,
we
had fun with it.
I think the club owner's name was Friedman. It was kind of a takeoff on Bud, wasn't it?
It was meant to be Bud name? Friedman. Oh, I don't remember, but it was, the whole thing was hilarious. And what was interesting for me as a producer was that we did a few comedy play setups. We did a couple one-man shows and a couple things that came off like a play. But this was the first multi-character. The audience was a part of the show. We immersed them.
Yeah, you got a picture. You know, you got a picture if somebody wants to picture it, because we're not really doing it justice because we can't do the hour and a half show for them, is picture the Larry Sanders Show meets Tony and Tina's Wedding.
Oh, great example.
Yeah, because we had the backstage stuff from the Larry Sanders Show because we had the voiceover that was overheard, and a lot of times we'd leak out stuff that you normally wouldn't say on stage just to give them exposition. And then the audience involvement was more like Tony and Tina's Wedding.
Yeah, it was really fun to do. The audiences, though, much smaller than we hoped, had a great time. And, you know, as they say, the show must go on. We made it work in a smaller venue with a smaller audience. And I took a huge bath financially. But I had so much fun doing it that
You know what? I did, too, because I had to pay all those people. You paid me, and then I paid them. So I didn't take a huge bath, but I took a good-sized one.
Yeah, it didn't work out the way we planned, and I always hoped at some point we could redo it, but it was kind of the moment was lost. But speaking of that, now you've done cruises, you've done lots of television, we've name-dropped several of the shows you've been on. In your career, Rick, what is there like a moment that really stands out that was, you know, maybe extra fun or good or maybe a huge disaster? What would you say your career?
Oh, I've had all of them. The one thing, the biggest gut punch was in 1988, I won the San Diego Lamp Off, right? Riding high, drove right from there, had a corporate gig in Palm Springs. You know, most money I've ever made, plus the $4,000 I won for winning the Lamp Off. Then I drove straight from there to Vegas. I was working at Rodney's place. Rodney had the Trop where the Laugh Factory is right now, same room. It was Rodney's, then it was the Comedy Stop at the Trop, then Bobby Slayton was there, then Brad Garrett was there, you know, and now it's back to the Laugh Factory, but that's the room, okay? So I was there starting on a Tuesday night or a Monday, no, Monday night, on a Monday night, and Rodney came in with Jeff Schimmel, and I had all my clothes on a rack in the back of my Volvo, and the rack fell down. Everything was wrinkled, and I got to the gig right in time for the show, so the only thing that wasn't wrinkled was that tuxedo I had, so I put the tux on. It's Vegas, what the hell? But Rodney didn't want that. Rodney didn't want clean Vegas-style Vegas acts. He had a special airing that Friday with the Dirty Guys, and that's what he wanted to promote. So when Rodney saw me, and I had been working in this club in New York for years, but he saw me, he just hated me. So I get a call the next day, you're fired. Now, no. When your idol fires you, there's not really much in the business that's going to hurt your feelings after that, you know? Because I've had like a cruise ship call me and cancel a gig, and I'm, you okay? You all right? Yeah, I'm fine. I think I'll be okay. My idol fired me. I've been, you know, my skin has gotten thick. So that's
Did they have a reason, or was it just that he felt it didn't fit the show?
It was both me and J.J. Wall, and his reason was he wanted edgy, dirty comics on that week because that was the week that was airing. And so he replaced us with, well, it doesn't matter who he replaced us with, but they were dirtier, but not necessarily edgier. But that was, Tony Camacho was booking us, so it was whoever Tony could find last minute to come in. And JJ and I went, but the funny thing was Bud Friedman was at the Las Vegas Comedy Convention a couple months later bragging about how two of his comics got fired for being too clean, you know? So, you know, it had its good and bad.
Well, it's so funny that you bring that up because it's been mentioned a couple times on the podcast. I really made a big, huge effort to produce clean shows because I felt Laughs Unlimited was a stepping stone to like the Tonight Show and stuff. And that if you're going to make it back in the 80s and early 90s, you had to, it benefited you to be clean. Now, that doesn't mean we didn't bring in edgier acts or dirty acts. Jack Marion was a regular and Bob Saget, who was always filthy on stage, but funny. But still, I preferred and always tried to get everybody to work clean because I thought it benefited them. And I think that's why Bud Friedman was laughing about it, is that how weird would it be, and understand the producer having his, you know, Piccadilly and wanting to go a certain way, but for Rodney not to use you because you were too wholesome and too clean.
No, Rodney was absolutely right, though. Rodney, you got to give Rodney credit. He made a lot of comedians' careers. And he was going the other way because everything you just said about being clean is true. You have a better chance of making it because you'll work more and you'll be sustaining your living, and you have a better chance of getting to the next level because you get better because you work more. There's more venues you can work when you're clean. But Rodney was trying to give the guys that didn't work that way a chance because he thought they were really funny. He broke Kennison. He broke Dice Clay, Bob Saget, all these people, you know, Lenny Clark. I mean, they all, because of Rodney, have careers, you know. So he was right. And at the time, I didn't realize it. I was, you know, it was very depressing. But Rodney was right.
Yeah, well, that's very gracious of you. But I'm sure that was, like you said, a gut punch to you personally in your career, just because, like you said, Rodney was an idol to a lot of comics, for somebody that, you know, struggled for years and then all of a sudden made it.
Here in Vegas in February, right, Valentine's Day, with John Mulrooney. And Harry, you know, Harry Basil books it. And Harry and Rodney were very close. Harry directed a couple of, wrote and directed a couple of Rodney's movies. They were good friends. He was on a special. And we were in the green room that Valentine's Day. And it just it came up. And I don't know how it came up. He goes, yeah, Rodney fired me. And Harry goes, yeah, I knew about that. That was horrible. You know, do you ever get over it? Yeah, I think just now, 30-something years later.
That's funny, though, that he was able to remember that and bring that up. Well, thanks for sharing that. Now, you've had a breadth of career, and we talked about the Sinatra stuff and the Dangerfield stuff. Was there somebody positive that you got a chance to work with when you were getting started that kind of supported you and that you looked to help you in comedy?
There were so many. You know, when I had that coveted middle spot that everybody loved, because you had no responsibility to MC, you just did 30 minutes, the crowd's warmed up, but you don't have to close. Everybody loved the middle spot, right? But when I had it, and that was, I guess, late 85 and then to 86 when I got Star Search. When I got Star Search, it solidified the middle spot for me. And I went on the road as a middle, and that was the time between when I MC'd for you and I came back as a headliner. Those 3 or 4 years in between, where I was middling and starting to headline, I got to work with Wolfberg. And I worked with Dennis Wolfberg like 6 times 1 year. Rich Scheidner like 6 times 1 year. Larry Miller. I worked with Seinfeld. And they gave such great advice. You know, I mean, I remember when I was, we used to play softball out in L.A. And there was a place in the valley that there was a dog that attacked people. So they moved it to a place off Barrington. Seinfeld called it, no more Pitbull Park. Pitbull Park. And so
that's funny.
The day that Seinfeld's show was going to premiere, the week before, they had a big article in that USA Today weekend section. The whole life section was devoted to Seinfeld's, you know, premiere. And I read it, and Seinfeld talked about a lot of, like, life things in it. And then I saw him at the softball, and I said, well, thanks for sharing that stuff, because it really spoke to me. He talked to me for like a half an hour about life, and he was just very, very helpful, you know. And Dennis Miller was very helpful to me. Louis Anderson was very helpful to me. Jeff Cesario. There was so many guys. And then when I worked ships, I got to work with some old timers. Like, I worked with Red Buttons.
Oh, wow.
And I was just telling the comic last night, I did the inaugural cruise of the Dawn Princess, right? And I worked on a ship with Red Buttons before, but he didn't know me, didn't see my set. But I'm on the first night in the big lounge, not the showroom, but the big lounge. And I get on stage and I go to meet my little friend and one of the dancers, a friend of mine, to have dinner afterwards. And I'm waiting outside and I get a tap on the shoulder. Nick, Red Buttons, you were great. And I mean, for that whole week, I was like his shadow. Everywhere we went, you know, I would hang out with Red because he had great stories and he was so helpful. And then I saw him years later at the Friars Club where they were putting Rickles' picture up, and I got a ticket to go. And I say, Mr. Buttons, we met a few years ago and we're on a ship. He goes, oh, yeah. I knew that. He didn't remember me, but he was old school, so he pretended he did. Oh, yeah, kid. Good to see you, kid. That's how they're supposed to act, you know?
Yeah, no.
Jimmy's, no, I remember a napkin somewhere.
Well, I just think, I know a lot of our audience may not even remember Red Buttons, but it is a...
Red Buttons won an Oscar in 19 in the 50s for Sayonara, his first acting role.
Yeah.
He was in with Brando. Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was
comic and actor.
He had his own show. Like in the 50s when Lucy had a show and Jack, was it Milton Berle had a show, and they were all competing, and he was one of the competitors. But he told me that he used to hang out at, was it Schwab's, the delicatessen in New York?
Right.
With some kid, and all the comics, you know, weren't really, really nice to the kid. except Red was. And then one day the kid's the writer of a movie called Sayonara, and he puts him in the movie and he wins an Oscar. So be nice to people. And yeah. The same thing happened with that Brian Koppelman and Alan Havey. I heard Koppelman on his podcast talk. You know, he produces the show Billions, and he goes, you know, Havey was like the only comic that was nice to me when I was doing open mics. And that he put him in the show. Havey's in the show.
Yeah. I've heard that story from a couple different comics that you gotta, you know, it's always wiser to be nice and respectful of everybody, whether they're above you or below you on the bill, because you never know what's going to happen down the road.
Yeah. So it's not even the show business thing. It's just a general life thing. Just be nice. What the heck?
Yeah,
it's much easier, actually.
It'll take you farther. So we got a chance to work together pretty regularly up into the mid and late 90s, but you and I haven't had a chance to work together the last couple decades. Why don't you share with the audience what's been going on? Have you focused on corporate or cruises, or was it kind of a mix mash?
I did some corporates. I didn't really I didn't like the chasing them down. I'm kind of a lazy businessman. And when you work the cruises, at one point, Royal Caribbean would give me my entire schedule for like a year and a half. And when you have that, you can relax. So what I was doing was I was trying to write screenplays because I had all this free time on the ships, and I was doing the ships. So I just go, let me do ships and write screenplays. I also had some voiceover stuff going, and those were the three things I was focused on.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
Then, yeah, I got some voiceovers, did a cartoon, did a couple things, and some commercials and stuff. But that was also another thing you have to chase. And I'm not a chaser guy. So I spent a lot of time writing scripts, and then once they're finished, oh, chasing again, you got to sell it. So I didn't like that either. But I mean, I spent 8 hours a day with writing partners and sometimes by myself writing movie scripts. And I guess I wasn't that good at it because after about 12 years, I couldn't sell any. So I just... Smirnoff's the one that talked me into moving to Florida, and I moved there in 2005, and I just focused on ships, and that's when I started writing more stuff with the guitar and just working on my stand-up act again and not caring about screenplays or whatnot.
But you're such a huge success, and I know that people take success in different ways. Like, you know, we both know people like Leno and Seinfeld that got their own series and ended up being, you know, Ray Romano, mega stars. And there's a lot of people, you know, Jeff Jenna, Tim Bedore, Steve Bruner, that had terrific careers that made a living doing comedy and in corporates. And you've had so much success because you have had the television exposure and you've been doing corporates and clubs. But to be a consistent performer on the cruise ships, people need to realize that's a real feather in your cap, because they won't just take anybody. You have to be able to be clean or dirty. They want both. And they also, I think it's great that they took advantage and appreciated what you brought musically.
Well, it's very difficult but you're right about you had to, they don't just take anybody. The screening process is kind of stringent now because there's so many comics that want to work there because the club scene is kind of dried up. If you're not a draw in clubs, why do they need you? They're not going to pay you. I mean, they'll hire you. They're not going to pay you anything because you're not putting people in seats. And that's the other attraction about this ship. The people are there. You just have to make people from all over the place. The challenge is you got to make people from all these different backgrounds, different countries even, laugh. So that's why guys do a lot of ship humor or whatever. But I try to avoid that because you want it to be universal. You know, you want to go back to land. But so the screening process was this. And I talked to Robin Cahill, who used to book Royal Caribbean. She was there for years when I first started over there. And she said, look, I booked you. You don't kill the first time, you're gone. There's 10 other people I could try. And she was right. So I was very fortunate when I got into Royal, which has been my major cruise line for the last 25 years.
Woohoo! Congratulations.
When I got in there, well, I was very lucky because all they tried me out doing was two late night shows. So you didn't have to be super clean, but you couldn't say the F word or anything like that. But the shows were 12:45 in the morning. So they basically bury the guy until we know if he's good, you know, in the back lounge. And I did well. So I got a good report. And this is the unbelievable luck that I had. When that good report came in, the same exact week, there was a guy that was double booking himself on Royal Caribbean and Celebrity, because this is before 9/11, where you could get off the ship in the middle and then just go to another ship. Right. And there was no hardly any security. So he was, but he occasionally, you'd miss a port and he was missing the ship. So by the third time he missed the ship, they fired him. I get all those dates. And I went from being a guy that had like a shift day here or there to like having a full calendar like that. And then when you do it, there's a learning curve. You know, you got a full calendar, you do it every week, you get better at it real fast. And in that year, I became a shitbag and I learned how to do it.
Well, that's amazing. And ladies and gentlemen, we want to celebrate that 25 years for one cruise line is a record as far as I know. So everybody...
It may be over, so I don't know. I got two more weeks booked and then nothing. So we'll see what happens.
25 years later. Yeah, 25 years later, you're on the brink. We don't know, but I still think it's amazing you've had that career. Well, Rick, it's been so great catching up, and what you've done with your career and your life in comedy and music has just been amazing. I'm going to share a little bit of your material. So what I was going to ask was, you've been in comedy now a long time. You've been very successful. Is there anything that you... know now that you wish you knew in the beginning?
That's a good question. Let's see. Is there anything? I just wish I knew to start earlier, you know, because that would have helped. But then again, you know, the engineering thing that everybody makes fun of me, they say overanalyze things. It's important to analyze things. Like, why is this joke not working? It's a similar discipline. So maybe I could have started earlier, but maybe not. Maybe things happen just the way they were supposed to happen.
Well,
you got to accept the things you cannot change, right?
Right, right. And I think you make a good point that the anal retentive part of being an engineer, the focus that you need to do the job right, you know, the pipes have to work and go the right way to make sure the nuclear plant works. Being able to break down a joke to understand what works and what doesn't work and the nuances of the timing and the verbiage is so important.
Yeah, sometimes the joke is the premise, the idea of it's very funny, but the way it's structured, they're not all getting it at the same time. So you have to structure the joke so that when the punchline hits, they all know it and you don't step on it. You know what I mean? So I have some jokes that they all get at different times, but they're still in the act because they're litmus jokes. If I tell the joke and some people get it really late, I go, well, I might have to bang them on the head a little harder. Because they're at a point now, I'm not saying they're stupid, they're at a point now where they've had a long day, they had a lot of drinks, they've been in the sun, and they don't want to think. They want to just have it handed to them.
You know what I mean? Lot of Friday night late show audiences.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. But the thing about Friday night late show audiences, that's land. On the ship, you know, it's Cozumel night. You got a midnight show, they've been in the sun all day. It's the same type of thing, you know.
That's funny. Well, that's interesting. I think the other thing, and I'm going to just throw out this opinion, was that you might have wanted to focus on the business side more.
Well, no, but I just didn't like that. Maybe I could have gotten lucky and got, like, it's all about starting earlier. If I was a young guy that was as funny at the age of 20 that I was at 30, then... every really good manager that could help you would have been, you wanted me and would have helped my career. And then if you have a good manager, you don't have to worry about the business side. That's their job.
Yeah. So
you know what I mean?
You're not saying you wish you knew more.
I think it's all about starting earlier.
Right. Right. Well, the point is it wasn't that you didn't understand the business. You just didn't like doing the business.
I don't like it. You know, I would be an engineer if I wanted to be a business, do business. I want to be an irresponsible comic that writes. You remember the Leno thing, write joke, tell joke, get checked.
Oh, that's so funny. Well, just to finish things up, this is going to be coming out in late 2022, this year. Is there anything you'd like to plug, or do you know where you'll be working late this year or next year?
I'll be on a ship that nobody's going to book at last minute. I'm doing a crossing from Fort Lauderdale to Spain and France, and I get off in Rome, so that'll be nice. But what I can plug, because I did a Drybar comedy special 5 months ago, they just sent it to me for a rough cut edit review, and I did that. So who knows how much longer it'll take to come out, but I'm thinking later this year. It's so funny, because I saw Geechee Guy the other night. He came into the club, and he said it took 5 years for his to come out. I go, don't tell me that.
How many years?
But I think 5 years. I guess something happened where his got, you know, back shelved and they forgot about it. But But they already sent me mine for edit review, so it won't be another five.
Oh, yeah, you won't be 5 years.
Probably the summer.
Well, we've had a few comics that have had the opportunity to do dry bar specials, dry bar comedy online. So, ladies and gentlemen, by the time you hear this, you can go to Dry Bar Comedy, look up Rick Corso, and you'll be able to see a new version of what Rick is providing entertainment-wise. Do you do any singing on that show?
There is some guitar stuff at the end of the special that I didn't do in the first show, but they put two shows together, and they found that was good enough in the second show to put it. Because my first show was flawless. Second show was a tough crowd, but the music at the end really worked. So they took that, and they put that in there. So there's a couple of original tunes.
Well, great.
With the guitar.
I'll be sure to check that out. Thanks so much. But right now, ladies and gentlemen, sit back. We have a little bit of old material.
I don't have to listen to it, do I? Can I just go?
No, we're going to go. But ladies and gentlemen, stay tuned. You'll enjoy this. Rick, it's been so great catching up. You have some great insights on comedy and musical comedy and working the cruise ships. Thanks so much for sharing your time. I hope you enjoyed doing this.
I enjoyed it, Scott. It's good to talk to you again, buddy.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, here we go with some great stand-up comedy by Rick Corso.
Favorite film was just on the TV very recently, The Wizard of Oz, great movie. You know, I look in the TV guide underneath Wizard of Oz, in parentheses it says, repeat. But did you see that remake, that Return to Oz, I think? Kind of disappointing. I really wanted Joan Rivers to play Dorothy the second time. Oh my God, you look so tacky. Munchkins grow up.
I would change the whole movie. Woody Allen would be the wizard.
It's incredible. You'd expect me to be a wizard. Guy has no heart. You should stay that way. Be a great lawyer.
Dustin Hoffman, thank you. Dustin Hoffman is Toto.
I don't want to be Toto. I want to be Dorothy. You saw Tootsie. I was Dorothy. Come on.
John Travolta is the scarecrow.
What?
Where? How am I supposed to know? I got a little brain. Robert De Niro is the Cowardly Lion.
Put him on. Did you step on my tail? Did you step on my tail? Did you step on my tail?
Wow, I should have opened with that bit. I'm an idiot. Thank you. Those are impressions. Well, my mother calls them imitations. I don't like that word, imitation. It kind of puts me in that category. Cheap handbags, fake furs, long and high. Right now they have this stuff in the supermarkets, imitation crab meat. You know there's not fish at the bottom of the ocean going, wait, into a great crab. And I thought, that stupid customs form, are you carrying more than $10,000 in U.S. currency? Look at it, pals. I'm flying coach on Southwest. Brown bag and a bologna sandwich. You don't have 10 grand to do with this. Now, airport security is supposed to be stricter. You know what? They're not even paying attention. You could walk through that metal detector completely naked. It's just flip-flops on. But the shoes in the tray, sir, are those shoes? I don't like them. And I don't like flight attendants. I think flight attendants are just a little condescending. You know, as soon as you get on the airplane, need any help finding your seat? Yes, I'm a complete moron. I can't count to 14. You want to help me out? One, two. I'm getting dizzy. Let me find my seat. Just point to the fattest guy in the plane because I sit next to him every time. Yeah, see over there, you'd be wedged between Roger Ebert and the Michelin Man. Now, shut up and bring tickets. There's always that one guy sitting right behind me, can't get up from his seat without yanking down to the back of my seat. Oh, great, just stretch your legs. I'll do the jerk. Good choice of food on the plane. You could either have the... And always wear long sleeves when you fly. If you wear short sleeves, you end up sitting next to the guy with the furry arms. Yeah. Fall asleep, have a caterpillar nightmare. And they sell luggage at the airport. Who goes to the airport unpacked? Balancing their personal possessions. This is awfully cumbersome. You got any Samsonite back there? Guy comes in wearing all his clothes on top of each other. Come on, I'm sweating my butt off. I can't bend my legs. I got 17 pairs of slacks on.
I always loved Frank Sinatra. You know, one of the things I loved about Frank Sinatra, he seemed to have a song for every town. He'd sing New York, New York, L.A. is my lady, Chicago. What if he worked in Nashville? Sang the square dance?
Swing your partner to and fro. Take that chick and do-si-do. Dig that cuckoo country sound. Promenade that broad around. Oh, thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was Rick Corso live on stage from back in the day. We really want to thank Rick for taking the time for doing this interview. I hope you got something enjoyable and interesting out of it. You guys are a terrific audience. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week for another great show. Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC. For information on the show, merchandise, and our sponsors, or to send comments to Scott, visit our website at www.standupyourhostandmc.com. Look for more episodes soon and enjoy the world of stand-up comedy. Visit a comedy showroom near you.